I have a regular correspondence with a lady and gentleman who have a son who has a mental defect. The son is retarded. Unfortunately, medical science does not seem able to do much for such people, and often they try to persuade the parents of such a child to commit the child to some home for the mentally defective. This particular boy is improving, and I believe that in time, with the loving care of his parents, he will become very much more normal. It seems that when he was a baby, a doctor treated him unwisely and tried out a new drug on the small baby, giving it a dosage which would have overpowered a strong adult. From that time on, the boy has suffered very great mental strain and he cannot speak, and I believe that his mental health is improving. I have suggested that he be sent to friends on the farm, because often if such a person is mixing with animals, etc., who are less privileged than he, then a great improvement takes place, as the boy or girl does all he can, or all she can, to help and to understand the animals. In many cases, a retarded child, seeing an animal, gets a type of fellow feeling. The child thinks that the animal cannot talk either, so that gives him a bond, and when such a child is given the run of a farm and given tasks within his or her capabilities, then the responsibility does start up and spark a response in the intelligence. It is such a shame, such a crime, to just rush retarded people off to a mental home when there is any hope at all that kindness at home, or kindness and understanding on a farm, will enable the retarded one to become less retarded. I have known many cases where Mongolian idiots — they are not idiots by any means — have been greatly improved by being placed in a position where they can help with animal husbandry. Do you remember in a previous book that I made a prediction that a president of the USA would be removed from office? Well, as I write this, we are waiting for President Nixon to announce his resignation. The poor fellow has had enough pressure, certainly, and according to what one reads in the papers, he is certainly having some nervous strain which may have affected his mental health. But anyway, predictions sometimes come right, you know. But I have been told quite reliably that President Nixon, probably former president when you read this, was informed by a quite well-known woman astrologer or whatever she is that nothing would happen to him. Well, she wasn't very successful, was she? Actually, everything comes in cycles. You get troubles with kings, presidents and all the rest of it in certain cycles. So if you know where to look, you can find out about these periodic cycles. In the same way, you can find out fairly accurately when a next war is going to happen. If you had been sufficiently interested to work out the dates of wars and you had drawn a graph of them, you would have found that they follow a more or less regular pattern. Everything happens like that, you know. Even with human life, everything happens in cycles, as every woman knows, and then there are the cycles of the moon's phases. But in addition to that, there are the cycles which affect humans most of all, such as the 23-day cycle of ups and downs of health, and the 28-day cycle, and another cycle which occurs over a period of 33 days. We get the health, the nervous energy, and the intellect, all fluctuating from top to bottom. And obviously, as the three cycles come together at fairly long intervals, then one can have an extremely good period for a day or so, or an extremely bad period for a day or so. I keep a regular chart of my cycles, that is, the 23-day, the 28-day, and the 33-day cycles, and quite recently I was at a peak of what passes for good health with me, as was predicted by the three cycles. But then there came the decline of the three cycles all in a bunch, and the result of that was that I was carted off to hospital, a very sick fellow indeed, with more pain than I like to think about. Then I stayed in the hospital until the cycles changed around and permitted me to feel better, after which I came out again. All life has cycles of this type, and if you know how they can be charted. Not only that, but if you know how you can find out the cycles of world events, what's going to happen to this country, what's going to happen to that, what sort of person is going to be assassinated next, and what those naughty little Russian lads are going to do to upset the equanimity of the world. It is a pity that the Russians are so xenophobic, because they make a lot of misery for themselves, always being absolutely positive that everyone else is against the poor little Russians, whereas actually most of the time people couldn't care to hoots for the Russians. They play pretty rough, though, as I know to my cost. Would it not be a very pleasant thing if we could get our lords and masters, who pose as a democratic elected government, to prepare proper charts showing world events and when we can expect an increase in income tax, or a wonderful event? A decrease in income tax, although the latter doesn't seem possible. The governments are always willing to put up the prices, to increase the taxes, etc., but they never do a darn thing about reducing them, do they? The income tax thing, I believe it came under one of the terms of the Defense of the Realm Act, DORA, in England during the 1914 to 1918 war, was just a temporary measure which was going to be repealed at the end of the war. Well, now, here in Canada as well as in the USA, the government of the country imposes a whacking great tax, and then the province or state take their bite as well by imposing a big tax, and in some places there is a third income tax, that which is imposed by a money-hungry city. It reminds me of the sort of life an author lives. First of all, he pays commission to one or two agents, and then he pays income tax in the country which is publishing a book, and then he loses money on the rate of exchange. It's never in my favor. And then he's got to pay tax, poor fellow, in his own country. And if he is particularly unlucky, he has to pay federal tax and then provincial tax, and if this is not his day, he has to pay city tax as well. After that, he may find that there is some sort of a school tax because the Catholics, for some strange reason, seem to have twisted the arm of the governments so they can dun money out of people to help pay for the schooling of little Catholics. It's a strange, strange world, isn't it? But my respected friend, Paddleboat Moffat, has a question. Paddleboat loves ships, and because of his love of ships, I renamed him Paddleboat, a name which it seems he thoroughly enjoys. Paddleboat Moffat is a very gifted model maker. To my disgust, he has been making silly old sailing ship models of an age long past. After all, who wants to know about ships which are mere lumps of wood blown along by a bit of cloth stuck onto a bit of a stick called a mast? All the best modelers make paddleboat models or good old steamships, and so Paddleboat Moffat, fired by his new name, is now busy making a paddleboat. But he is puzzled about the Marie Celeste. You probably all know about her, but if there is Aunt Agatha out there who doesn't know, let me tell you, Auntie, that the Marie Celeste is, or was, a sailing ship which was plying her regular route across the seas, and then one day, or rather, one evening, an oncoming ship saw the Marie Celeste coming towards her with all sails set, booming along in front of the wind. But like this book, it was twilight, and according to marine law, the Marie Celeste should have headlights showing, but there were no lights, and the people aboard the oncoming ship were perturbed at several things which seemed wrong with the Marie Celeste. So after quite a long chase, some of the men from the spectator ship were able to board the Marie Celeste and lower the sails. Then they got goose flesh, or whatever it is that seamen get when they are scared stiff, because there was no one aboard the Marie Celeste, no one at all. Everything was perfectly in order, even a meal was laid out on a table waiting for an unknown diner. Throughout years and years, many conjectures have been made as to what happened aboard the Marie Celeste. There was no sign whatever of any violence, so what could it have been? The lifeboats were there so the crew could not have taken off from what they thought was a sinking ship. The ship was perfectly in order, nothing at all wrong with it, except the crew were not aboard, and that is all. There have been quite a lot of ships like that. The ships have been intact in perfect order, and yet there has been no one aboard. And then if you will read my other books, you will read about the Bermuda Triangle, in which not only ships have lost their crews, but the ships themselves have disappeared. Aircraft have disappeared as well, and in at least one authenticated case, voices were heard on the radio fading out in eerie, ghostly fashion. Paddleboat Moffat wants to know what happened. Well, there is another time dimension which crosses our world. There is another world intermingled with ours. A lot of people say, well, if that is so, why can't we see it? You cannot because it is on a different frequency. Think of it like this, I don't know how many of you are interested in shortwave radio, but quite a number of you will have had the acquaintance of listening to a shortwave station. Oh, let's say just for example, the BBC on a 31-meter band, and then find that the station appeared to drift off and instead there would be perhaps Moscow, the voice of Moscow bellowing out propaganda against the capitalist countries. And then, even before one could reach for the tuning knob, the drift would occur again, bawling Moscow would disappear and the BBC would come back. All the time, of course, both stations were broadcasting, but the set was tuned to one, and if there was a frequency drift somewhere the other would come in instead. We get the same thing with the two worlds. The worlds are invisible to each other. Let me put it in another way, we here on this world see by a certain type of light, but supposing our light was switched off and something else, perhaps infrared, was switched on, then we would apparently be in darkness, but a person who could see by infrared light would be able to see perfectly, whereas he would not be able to see at all by our light. So it is that in such a case, if our world is at one frequency and our twin world is at another frequency, there is no interaction between them, so one world is not aware of another, but in, by way of illustration only, the two worlds intermingling at the Bermuda Triangle particularly, and then there is a drift. Any poor soul at the point of the drift would possibly find that he had slipped from one world into the other. He would get a nasty shock, wouldn't he? The other world is a twin of this world, so when he had sailed or flown over the barrier and into this other world, he would be in a similar type of world and in a similar location on that world, but he wouldn't know the language, he might not even see so well, he might find that he was seeing almost as one would see at twilight. Hey, I can't get away from that word, can I? But you can rest assured that people from the other world come to this one as well. In fact, I know of a definite authentic case where it happened in Argentina because I was near at the time. But that is another story. So, paddle boat Moffat, the Marie Celeste and other ships could still sail if they went over the border, but it might even be that in the case of the Marie Celeste the crew were taken off for examination by a UFO, or even by another ship which was on the other side of the barrier. Either is possible. And both have happened in the case of other ships. Chapter 10, I have been listening to The Tragedy of a Nation, using my little old transistor radio, and I am just overcome by the tragedy of it all. Of course, by the time you read this book the news will be old. Possibly even the new president will have left. I should never be surprised nowadays. But I have been listening to The Tragedy of a Nation. The tragedy is not the doings of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, I would say, is no saint. In fact, I should imagine that he can grow horns on his head far more easily than he would grow wings on his shoulders, but Richard Nixon has done a lot of good, and to my way of thinking he has done no more harm than some of the other people who have been presidents of the USA. The tragedy of the USA is not the tragedy of the president. The tragedy is that the press, those evil dastardly men of the press, have caused all the trouble. And I cannot understand why presumably sane people tolerate the press. There should definitely be a press censorship, but to be crude about it, none of the politicos have the guts to impose it or even to suggest it. I well know how the lying press can fabricate the evidence, and then the press will accuse a person, try him, and condemn him without one iota of real guilt on the person concerned. I am not saying that President Nixon was innocent. Not even the most potent of those wonderful cleaning powders which are so freely advertised would make President Nixon snow white, no matter how many times he was dunked in the stuff, but he was not as bad as he was painted by the press, and I will go so far as to say that he has not done anything worse than any other president has done. I thoroughly understand President Nixon's point of view, and I should class him as a perfectly ordinary commonplace in the rut American president. The press have no right to interfere in politics any more than the churches have. It is always a source of amazement to me that in Ireland, for example, one Bible thumper has left his lectern, or flown the pulpit, to become one of the revolutionaries. What's the fellow's name? Paisley, I believe. But if a man goes in for holy orders, why does he suddenly start giving revolutionary orders? You get the same thing with old Makarios, who ran so fast from Cyprus that no one could catch him. He is another one, this time an archbishop, and he forgot his holy teachings to enter the revolutionary path, and revolutionaries, it seems to me, are nothing but a gang of murderers. We are all entitled to our opinions, and that is my opinion. I think that a cleric who forgets his holy teaching and runs bleating from his flock to pick up a rifle should be unfrocked. Not merely should he be unfrocked, he should be debagged. Debag is a good old English term, so for the American audience let me say that he should be peeled from inside his pants. I have had a lot of persecution by the press, and although I cannot truly say I hate anyone, I am as near hating the press as I am anyone in the world. I would prefer to shake hands with Satan and his grandmother. Does Satan have a grandmother? Then I would to shake hands with a pressman, because these people are truly the scum of the earth. One listens to them on the radio and one shudders at the arrogant way in which they dictate to people, shudders at the manner in which they try to force a person to say what the pressman wants them to say. And then in the matter of the new incumbent, Gerald Ford, I listened to the pressmen saying what the new president would do. Well, if the press people are so important, so all-knowing, then why does America need a president? Why doesn't the Senate or Congress or the Boy Scouts or something just phone the press each morning to know what orders they should give? The press people, it seems to me, are just a lot of illiterate, ignorant fools who are just ready to cash in on anyone's misery, and even on a nation's tragedy. Pox to the press. I have a letter from a person who cannot understand this. Well, in your books, and in other books too, it is said that every so often the world undergoes a sort of change of cycles, a change of civilization, but if that is so, then there must be remnants of other civilizations and we never find any, so it leads me to think that you are not telling the truth. It leads me to the belief that the Bible is right and the world is only about 3 or 4 thousand years old. That fellow must be a pressman. But anyway, imagine for a moment that you are an ant playing about in some farmer's field. Well, you see this great cloud coming from the distance, and because you are a wise ant, you scurry as fast as you can to the nearest tree and you shin up that tree with all 6 or 8, or whatever it is, legs. Then you get a first-class view of the world beneath you. The farmer stops his chuffing tractor and gets down and opens the gate to the field. Then he gets back on the tractor and chuffs away through the gateway and into the field. Then after he has scratched his head a bit, lit a cigarette, and done a mighty spit, he hitches a plow up behind the tractor. And then what was your world? The smooth surface of your world with nice green grass and good clumps of weeds, gets in a state of turmoil. The farmer is plowing. He goes on plowing and plowing, and he is deep plowing, too, so all the surface of your world, which is that field, is broken up and the inner soil comes to the surface and everything is thoroughly messed up. Your friends in the ant colony disappear forever. One of the plow blades saw to that in very decisive fashion. The ant colony was tipped upside down, and then great clods of earth rained down on them, and after that one of those blade things at the end of the plow sliced right through the earth, covering the deceased colony, and all the sides caved in even more. On the next pass down the field, one of the rear wheels of the tractor pressed everything down deep. Well, you, the last ant in all the world, your world is the field, remember, shudder with fright. Everything has taken on a new look. There are great cliffs of earth standing up where before there was smooth earth and perhaps grass. There is nothing that you know left anymore. But if you were given long life, I don't know how long in ant lives, you would see the winds and the rains beat down the plowed up soil until everything became smooth again. But before that, perhaps, the farmer or his boy would come along with a seeder, which is another device which turns up the earth a bit and scatters seed all over the place. And that cedar would be followed by hordes of birds. So you, poor ant, had better keep your tail down tight or you will lose it. But that is how things go on this earth. There is what we of the earth call a mighty civilization. New York, for instance, is it mighty after Watergate? Supposing the end of a cycle had come, there would be terrific earthquakes, bigger earthquakes than you had ever dreamed possible, and you wouldn't dream about them either because you wouldn't live through them. The earthquakes would open chasms in the earth and buildings would fall in. Chasms would extend perhaps half a mile deep into the earth, and all the buildings which were New York would fall in. Then the earth would close again, and there would be a few wriggles, and in course of time there would be no trace whatever of that mighty civilization. The waters would change their course. The Hudson would disappear into the earth, the seas would sweep over part of the earth perhaps, and perhaps New York's site would become the seabed, and everything that you knew of New York would have disappeared. It's not true, though, to say that everything is lost without trace forever and ever, amen, because there have been most interesting reports from deep miners. They have been digging for coal, perhaps, and far down in the depths of their mine they have come across, and this is true, a figure buried in coal, a figure which might be 15 feet long. They may also come across certain artifacts. And there have been such artifacts found and placed in museums. There have been cycles and cycles on this earth. If you go to a farm and look out across the farmland, you can't say what sort of crop there was 10 years ago, can you? You can't say what sort of crop there was 20 years ago, not even 5 years ago, not even 1 year ago, because everything has been plowed down. Perhaps the farmer has had a very good crop which has depleted the earth. So he ploughs the land and lets it lie fallow for a year. After that he ploughs it again and plants a different crop, and so it goes on. The earth, too, is ploughed by earthquakes, and after the earthquakes come the floods and the tornadoes which blow the topsoil and smooth everything off and make sure that there is no trace of that which went before. So, young man, you who write and tell me that I am not telling the truth, you are talking through the back of your neck. You don't know the first thing about all this, so the sooner you read all my books, and believe them, then the better for you. Mrs. Mary McMaggot of the Maggotorium, Toadsville, is a great herb fan. She firmly believes that people who take chemicals, and that means chemical drugs and all that sort of stuff, should have their brains tested. Mrs. Mary McMaggot is absolutely convinced that you get good only from herbs. She thinks the rest of the pills, potions, liniments and lotions are just a device to make money for the drug houses. Actually, there isn't any difference usually between the drugs we get out of herbs and the drugs which are made in a factory. You know how it all happens, don't you? Well, let's take as our example a herb which is rich in iron. Now, the iron in that plant does not grow there provided by a benevolent nature who knows that in time Mrs. McMaggot will want an iron tonic. The iron came from the ground, and I am going to advise you to look on things something like this. All plants are cellulose, they are like cellulose sponges, and the cells in the sponges are filled with the life material of the plant. The cellulose is a form of skeleton, a form of support for the plant. So this particular plant that we are examining is very partial to soil which has a strong iron or element in it. It grows well in such circumstances. And the iron ore is absorbed by the far-spreading roots of the plant and is then taken up by the sap and conveyed through all the cellulose tissues of the plant. There it is lodged in those cavities just as one can mop up dirty water with a sponge and get the sediment lodged in the cells of the sponge. Well, along comes a herbalist, grabs a handful of iron-bearing plants and messes about with them. Perhaps he makes a tea of them, perhaps he mashes them up. But anyway he makes some awful unsavory goo and takes the stuff. If he was lucky and he's got hold of a plant which had been successful in getting a good quantity of iron ore, he feels better for it. But if he finds a barren sort of plant, then he says some naughty words and goes on to some pills. All the big drug houses send research teams into exotic parts of the world, such as to the interior of Brazil. There the research people find all manner of plants which grow nowhere else in the world perhaps, because Brazil is truly a wonderful, wonderful country for its natural resources. The plants are carefully noted, photographed, checked, and then bundled up and sent to research laboratories where they are again examined in the light of information which has been obtained from natives. Perhaps a native witch doctor uses this herb or that herb for curing barrenness or rheumatism, or something else. Well, the native witch doctors are usually right, they have generation after generation of passed on experience to guide them, so you can be sure that if they say that such and such a plant is good for this or that complaint, they are perfectly correct. The research teams break down the plants, analyze them, make them into essences, make them into crystals, and they find out every single item about the plant, what it consists of, what it is secreted, and all the rest. And as is very frequently the case, they can isolate a certain chemical which is responsible for the cures claimed by the witch doctors. Then, having that chemical further analyzed, they can copy it exactly. So we have the chemical of the plant merely duplicated by the chemical in the laboratory. The man-made thing, and the man-made thing has a great advantage over the herbal chemical because there is no method of telling the potency of the herbal chemical, there might indeed be none. But if a thing is copied and manufactured in the laboratory, then one can at all times prescribe an absolutely accurate dose. I am thinking particularly of curare. Certain of the Amazon Brazilians, they call them Indians, used curare extract on arrows or spears. And if they shoot an arrow so coated at an animal, the animal keels over, paralyzed. But there is a lot of hit or miss because, again, in a herb which grows in the ground, you can't be sure of your dosage. Years ago it was found that curare was useful to surgeons in paralyzing a patient on the operating table and making his muscles relax. But when the herb was administered, the results were uncertain. Either the poor wretch was killed, or, often, he did not get a strong enough dose to be effective. But now that the drug curare is manufactured artificially, there is no risk because at all times there is an exact dosage. So, Mrs. Mary McMagoat, it's a good thing that we can have factory-made chemical drugs which permit us to prescribe and dose with accuracy. Just think if you had to go out and chew up a pound of fennel before you found your cough was curing. Now you can take a little liquid and find that you can get your cough better really fast. Another person writes and asks what I think of Arabs and Jews. Well, to tell you the truth, I don't think anything particular about them because while on earth they are much the same type of people. Arabs and Jews were very friendly indeed just a few years ago. They mingled, Arabs in Jewish communities and Jews in Arab communities, and they were on the closest terms possible. There was no dispute between them, no dispute at all. But, you know, one of the facts of life is that love and hate are very similar, very close. You can have absolute love for a person which turns to absolute hatred almost overnight. Or you can have a most vicious, bitter enemy, and then you can find that you love her almost before you know what is happening. It is because the chemicals are wrong in the two people concerned. It might be that Arabs and Jews have changed their eating habits somewhat, and so that the chemical intake leads to the opposition of their vibrations. If a person's vibrations are not compatible with another person's, then we have hatred, and the vibrations are very often governed by the sort of food we eat because the food gives us our chemical intake. That is why in so many cases mega vitamin treatment works wonders, and in other cases it can have no effect at all. So if we got a bunch of Jews and a bunch of Arabs and we fed them on the same stuff, perhaps they would get on together and not try to cut each other's throat behind their back, so to speak. But I know, or knew, quite a lot of good Arabs, and I now know quite a lot of good Jews. Unfortunately, I have met one or two bad ones as well, but then I have also met some bad Buddhists. Often I get letters from Germany really giving me a working over because my books are not published in Germany. I can't help that. There was quite a campaign against me in Germany started up by a few fellows who were jealous because I wrote about Tibet, jealous because I wrote true books about Tibet, and so quite a press campaign was started against me. But it seems to me that the Germans are an unlovely people. It seems to me that they are the troublemakers of Europe. They are so humorless, so deadpan, so righteous. So much so that I have had to decide that I wouldn't have my books published in Germany. I cannot stand these literal people, and I have often written to people in Germany and given them my honest opinion, which is that it would have been better for the rest of Europe, perhaps, if the Russians had taken over the whole of Germany.